Hello, this is Caleb Keith, the director of the 1517 Podcast Network, with an important announcement from the network to you. During the month of June, your favorite podcasts from 1517 are going to be participating in a podcast fundraiser. During this time, we are seeking to raise $50,000 for the 1517 podcasts. The 1517 Podcast Network has created free gospel-centered content for over 5 years. We have new episodes of our 19 podcasts coming out every day of the week, and we never fill them with ads or place them behind a paywall. That's why this June, we're asking listeners across our shows to support 1517 and the teachers and creators behind your favorite theological resources. Your support directly impacts our ability to build and maintain podcast content that was listened to over 6 million times last year alone. Thank you to the listeners who enjoy and share our podcast. A special thanks to those who financially support our shows. We hope that you consider supporting this podcast and the rest of the network during our June fundraiser. And again, that goal is $50,000. One of the easiest ways you can help is by signing up for a monthly recurring donation. All you have to do is follow the Support This Show link at the top of the show notes or go to 1517.org/donate-podcasts to support your favorite shows. Again, we appreciate your support. Enjoy this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. You can check out a new podcast that's living over there called Tough Text. That features myself and Scott Keith. I know you're thinking, Dan, don't you do like an Old Testament podcast with Chad? Don't you do a New Testament podcast with Eric? Aren't you going over all the text? Yeah, we are going over all the text, but sometimes you need another perspective. And in this particular podcast, it's only 25 minutes long. And we're just going over hard text and really, really challenging ourselves. Every episode is a challenge where you're dealing with a text that Sunday school avoids. So you can check out that podcast. It's called Tough Text. You can subscribe. You should do that. Also, as you heard on the front end of this show from the podcast director, Caleb Keith, we are in the midst of the Podcast Network fundraiser. As you know from listening to the show, there's no ads on this show. This is not because we don't get hit up to do ads. We do. We get asked to talk about that Squarespace, talk about those MeUndies, whatever it is. I get those emails. But we don't do that because we don't want to make you listen to that. And we also don't have a paywall. It's not as like, you know, it's not like if you want to go listen to what we have to say about Exodus, you have to go back and have a subscription to get to past episodes or anything like that. No, you just go listen to them. It's free for everybody. And the way that it is free for everybody is that some people contribute. And so for those people, we say thank you very much. Thank you for making it possible. We also ask that during this time when we're trying to raise money, you know, particularly for this podcast and the entire network, that you consider contributing to that fundraiser. And if you've never given, this would be a great time to do it to help us hit those goals so that we can continue to do what we do and continue to have it be free for you, your friends, and the whole world. So thank you very much. You can go to 1517.org/donate-podcast with an S, or the easy way to do it is just go to the show notes, and you'll see that link that says support this show, and you just click that, and it'll take you right to that fundraiser. We appreciate it. Chad, we are in Nehemiah chapter 3. Nehemiah has been sent out. He's gathering the timbers. He's got some letters. He's going to do some building. Does he have any experience with building? Probably not, but he's going to go and see what can be done to repair what is in disrepair. And there's some guys that were, you know, kind of interested in helping him or maybe wanted to, you know, a little curious about what's going on. And he said, hey, guess what? You don't have any part in this, and we're not going to have your help. We're not going to tell you what we're doing. You can just keep walking down the road, buddy. And that was quite the burn. That burn is going to leave a mark.
Yeah, yeah. These guys are going to come back later. And, well, they're going to jeer and taunt, which they've already done. But they're going to they're going to make some plans to see what they can do to at least slow down, if not completely destroy, this project that the Israelites are engaged in. So, yeah, beginning of chapter three, well, all the way through chapter three, we're going to hear about everybody that's involved in the process. A lot of names. And if you're familiar with Nehemiah 3 and you're thinking, is Chad going to actually read this whole chapter? Fear not. I am not, actually. We usually do.
I'm going to read it. Surprise.
Oh, Dan's going to read it. That's right. You can do all the Hebrew names.
I'm not going to do that.
Fish gates and sheep gates and dung gates and east gates. And yeah, we got a lot of stuff going on here.
One thing that's cool about this chapter, as we're not going to read all of it, but kind of summarize, what you do see is that Nehemiah is a pretty good, I don't know what he knows about building, but he knows about organizing, it would appear, because you have to assume he's leading this charge. And he does somehow rally the troops, as it were, and he's got different groups of people or different families all doing different things. So it does seem that he's got some organization going on here of how we can. It's not as though, like, okay, the first thing we're going to do is build this thing, and so everybody goes over there, and you're working on, you know, this section of wall or this gate, and then everyone moves over there. No, he's got it divided up, and different people, groups, and different families are working on different things, and so you kind of get this idea that the whole thing's going to rise up together.
Yeah, and the impression I get too is that you have a group cohesion going on. And part of what builds that cohesion is the fact that they've got a common enemy, right? They got a common goal. They're going to build a wall. But they also have a common enemy. And we've already heard about them. We're going to hear more about them down the road. In fact, they're going to threaten them so much that guys are going to start, you know, they got a hammer in one hand or a trowel in one hand, and they got a sword or a bow in the other hand. So they're going to be carrying weapons while they're also building the wall. So they got group cohesion. They're united in this effort, but they also have a common enemy, which of course is a good glue that holds people together. And, you know, another aspect of, I think, Nehemiah's leadership, and I don't know if he was the mastermind behind this or not, but this is the way it played out, is you had kind of this common goal, but you also had personal investment, because several times I noticed when I was reading through all the details in the chapter, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so did the repairs opposite their house. So it's the idea that, hey, you know, if you live, say, on the eastern side of Jerusalem or the south side or wherever you live, we want you to work on the wall that's directly opposite to your house, which, you know, makes perfect sense, you know, so you're not like going all the way across Jerusalem and you're helping this guy build his wall close to his house. No, it's right there where you live. So, I mean, there's this kind of this personal investment idea too. I want to make sure that where I live, opposite my house, the walls in good shape. Another thing I kind of like about this is just kind of from the whole perspective of community, is that almost everybody is involved in this. You start out with chapter three saying that the high priest with his brothers, the fellow priest, they're going to build the sheep gate, and they're going to consecrate it. They're going to set its doors. They're going to consecrate a couple of towers. And so from the high priest on down, you got people involved. Then later in the chapter, you hear about the Levites who are involved. And one guy, I don't know which verse that is, but one guy, his daughters are helping him out too. So I was like, hey, everybody, hey, kids, grab some bricks, grab some stones, you know, make a run to Home Depot and make sure we have plenty of concrete for whatever we're doing here. So despite the fact that Robert Alter describes this as one of the most boring chapters in the Bible, and granted, it's not like intellectually stimulating, but still, it's pretty fascinating when you kind of step back and you view kind of the big picture of what's going on here. I mean, come on, you get a whole city involved in something like this. That's pretty impressive. And I'm with you. I think it probably stems mainly from Nehemiah's leadership. Yeah, he was a cupbearer to the king, but you kind of get the impression that this guy, he wasn't just somebody who knew his wines. You know, he probably, from all those years of serving in the king's court, he picked up on a lot about how leadership works, how organization works, how community works. And he was used by God. That's the reason God chose and used Nehemiah for this, because he had the skills necessary to pull this off. So we kind of move in a counterclockwise fashion around the city of Jerusalem as each of these sections of the wall and gates are described. And there's a ton of gates. You got Sheep Gate, Fish Gate, Gate of Yeshanah, Valley Gate, Dung Gate, Water Gate, East Gate, Muster Gate. And most of these, I mean, some of these, you know, archaeologists and historians have been able to kind of pinpoint some of these, who knows, you know, but as it is with all ancient cities that had walls, you don't have just one gate. I mean, you have other places where you have a chance for people to enter and to exit. In fact, so my wife and I just got back a few days ago from a trip to Greece, and we visited several of the Greek islands, and we were in Rhodes, and we did a medieval walking tour, and part of that city still has the medieval walls. And it was kind of cool. I was thinking about that trip and Nehemiah 3, because when you walked along, you had like, oh, here's a gate. You go another quarter mile. Here's a gate, another quarter mile. There's a gate. And these are, I mean, this is super thick walls, super impressive gates. I mean, that's just one example. Of course, that's from the Middle Ages, but kind of this way of building thick walls and having gates here and there for various reasons. I mean, that continued all the way from the days of Nehemiah up until to the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, you got to have lots. Anyway, you got to have lots of gates because you know, if you have one way in, that means you only have one way out, which is not good.
Yeah. So, if you go to Jerusalem today and you drive around, you can see the remains, not of these gates, because these are underneath the surface now, but there were still gates in the old city walls that you can tell were there for various reasons. So, I mean, it's speculation to some extent, but probably the Sheep Gate, because it's connected here with the priest, I'm guessing, was where the sheep were brought in that were used for sacrifice. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. So Elisha, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests, and they built the Sheep Gate, and they consecrated it. And interestingly, I looked in the rest of the chapter. These are the only gates that are consecrated. So it kind of makes sense that this would have been in connection with the temple. So they consecrate that and the tower. And so the guys from Jericho were also building. And that makes sense, too, because we know, at least from later evidence, that a lot of the priests lived in Jericho. Of course, that jives with the parable of the Good Samaritan. The priest is heading down from his service at the temple to Jericho because, well, that's where a lot of the priests lived. So anyway, we start out there with those guys, and then pretty soon, verse 4, we have mention of repair, azak in Hebrew. And I think, if my memory serves me here, 34 times that verb is used in this chapter. It's, of course, a major theme. Then you have, sometimes you have, no doubt, starting from scratch, but most of the time you have repairs going on. They're repairing gates, repairing walls, and later on, we'll hear about they got it kind of halfway done. The wall is built halfway up. So anyway, a lot of repairs going on, a lot of building going on, and most everybody involved. There is one group here who, as the ESV has it, would not stoop to serve the Lord. So he has some guys from Tekoa, the Tekoites, which was just a little ways there from about, a few miles from Jerusalem. So some of them, the Tekoites, did work, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. Literally in Hebrew, they would not put their necks, the idea of kind of putting your neck in a yoke in order to serve. So I don't know what these guys' problem was. Maybe they thought they were too good for that. We'll let everybody else take care of that.
Yeah, nobles here is probably just like, you know, sort of like, you know, the upperclassmen of that particular group, right? We're like... Oh, it's great that you're repairing the walls, but I mean, I'm not going to get dirty or break a sweat. Yeah. I'll send some people. One thing that you could take away from this is that it tells you that these people weren't, which makes you assume that all the other sort of people of higher class or whoever they are, the leaders of different groups, that they were, because they're. It's only mentioned that these ones didn't, so you have to assume the rest of them did.
Yeah. In fact, you go down to verse 12, it says that next to him, Shalom, the son of Halosha, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. He and his daughters. So he's the one who had his daughters involved helping out. Maybe he didn't have any sons, and so he put his daughters to work. But either way, I mean, he's a leader. He's a noble there in Jerusalem, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem. So he's out there working. Everybody kind of, you know, they get their trowel, they get whatever else they needed, and they go to work because the wall has to be built. And united as they were, they're able to actually make some great progress and set the gates and the doors, the bolts, the bars of the gates, and they're making a pretty good progress. And I know that's basically the summary of the chapter. I don't know if there's anything else that we need to add about it. If you're really into details, well, then you can check it out. All the names, all the places, all the gates, and kind of where everybody was located opposite their house doing the repairs necessary to get it all put back together before they had some more trouble with these guys that we're going to hear about at the beginning of chapter four.
I suppose if you're looking for like a good biblical name, you could read through this chapter. You know, maybe you're pregnant or your wife's pregnant, and you're like, I want a name that no one else has. You want that real original yet biblical name. You don't want to go with John or Matthew. You want to do that. You know, you want somebody.
You
You
want
want to,
Benui. Benui.
You can get one of these guys, and you know, I mean, how about this? I mean, you could name your kid, you know, Shalom, and then people are like, "Hey, what? That's a weird name." You're like, "Yeah, this is a noble guy that does work." You know, I mean,
I love it.
what a great biblical flex that you could have.
I can't remember the example, but one of the commentaries that I was reading said that some of these seem to be nicknames. And I wish I could remember the instance of one of these guys, and literally in Hebrew, it's Pug Nose. So he gives names. So maybe you want to check a Hebrew dictionary before you chose some of these names. But yeah, there's pretty good names there. You know, and this is totally off subject, but a name, a biblical name, we need to recover more is Abraham. I mean, do you know anybody named Abraham personally?
I actually do not. I know, our good friend Noah.
Yeah.
His middle name is Abraham. I do know that.
Oh, nice. Nice. Two. Wow. I'm man. Noah just rose even higher in my
Noah
estimation.
Abraham. Yeah,
Yeah, two, not just two Old Testament names, but two Genesis, two Torah names. Wow.
Guess if this guy was raised in church or not.
Yeah, take a wild guess on that one. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, if you're looking for names, looking for details, looking for how to provide a little bit of leadership and group cohesion to a task, well, here you go. Nehemiah 3 is all about that.
Yep.
So anyway, that's that chapter. We'll jump into chapter 4 now, and we're going to hear about our friend Sanballat, or Sanballat, or however you want to say his name. The one that we heard about at the beginning of the podcast, the one who wasn't so happy about rejection. So we hear that he gets word that the work on the wall is proceeding, and he's not very happy about this. In fact, he was angry, not just angry, but greatly enraged. So just in case you didn't get the point, he wasn't just mad. He wasn't just angry. This dude is like greatly enraged over this. Presumably because we talked about this guy before, presumably because, you know, up until Nehemiah's arrival, this guy is able to kind of control things. You know, even if he's not the ruler of Jerusalem, yeah, he's got his thumb in the pie and he's able to kind of control things. And then this cupbearer that nobody's ever heard of shows up and does this little reconnaissance trip, middle of the night, checking things out, and then gets everybody worked up and eager to work to rebuild the wall. And the next thing you know, this thing is halfway built. So he is not happy about the progress. And so his response is to jeer at the Jews. So he's going to start out with some verbal attacks here. And
He's probably a little nervous to do like anything more than jeer, at least initially. Like, I mean, this is sort of like a authorized endeavor, right? And Nehemiah made sure that he had the paperwork in order.
yeah, it's not as if Nehemiah just, you know, gets this idea, this harebrained idea. And you know, gets on his horse and travels all the way from Babylon to Jerusalem and says, "Hey guys, I have this idea that we should do this." No, he's got documentation, he's got authorization, straight from the king.
Yeah. I think if he doesn't have that, it was much more difficult to accomplish without people trying to stop you from doing it.
Oh yeah, they would have shut this down immediately. And well, in fact, they did shut down, as we talked about in one of the earlier podcasts. They sent letters earlier to the king saying, "Hey, you really ought to check out these Jews, because there's a long history of them being rebels, and they had some great leaders in the past. And the last thing that you want is for them to become strong again. So it would be our recommendation that all building in the city stop." And the king's like, "Yeah, I had a little research, and yeah, that's probably best." So anyway, he's greatly enraged, jeers the Jews, and then he's gonna talk to his buddies. He says, in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, he's got these five rhetorical questions. What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish, and the burned ones at that? So he starts out kind of, I don't know, I kind of get the impression he's just trying to rally the troops here and vent a little bit his frustration and make it sound as if this is never going anywhere. But all the while, kind of beneath the surface there, you can tell he's nervous, because obviously they are making progress, even if they have just, heaps of rubbish, stones that have been partially burned, which is going to weaken the stones if they get that hot. But hey, the work is proceeding.
This definitely seems like you're mocking something out of, but you're obviously frustrated when you try to act like you're brushing something off, but you can't stop talking about it. So people know that you're actually a little bit obsessed with it.
Yeah. You protest too much.
Yeah. Like you're like, "Oh, I don't care about that. It's nothing." But like, it's all you talk about day and night.
But that's all you can talk about all the time. So obviously you are pretty concerned about it. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then after Sanballat finishes his little five question jeer, Tobiah, the Ammonite, he's got a few choice words to say too. He jumps in and he says, "Yeah, what are they building? If even a fox, a little canine, this could be translated jackal too. If a fox or a jackal goes up on it, then the stone wall is going to break down." So a little hyperbole going on there too. If my dog jumped on that wall, it would fall down. These guys don't have any idea what they're doing. There's no way this is going anywhere. So Sanballat and Tobiah, they both are trying, maybe they're trying to convince themselves or they're trying to convince other people that this is a lost cause. So, this is happening. We find out in a couple more verses, this is overheard, as it were. It's good. This is uttered in the presence of the builders. So you kind of get the impression that, they're hanging around, they're jeering, they're making these accusations and these asking these questions. And people hear this, the rumor mill is going on that, hey, that's what's being said about this. So how's Nehemiah going to respond? Well, we said early on that when we started covering this book, that you get a much more well-rounded picture of Nehemiah than you do Ezra. It's right. Kind of what kind of person he is. And I think we're going to see a little bit more here too, because listen to this prayer from Nehemiah. Nehemiah is just, he's a pretty straight shooter. He says, he doesn't speak to them. This is the prayer that he utters. "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders."
That's pretty rough.
That's some imprecatory Psalms language there, is what that is.
It definitely is. I mean, now there's a lot of things that you could pray, maybe against your enemies. So, "Hey, God, we're being despised here. Turn back these words, these taunts on their own heads." You're like, "Oh, okay, like that's understandable. Like, okay, what you say is going to come back to bite you." But did it not stop there? And then to say, also, give them a little taste of what we've had. Maybe give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Now, this sounds like something that Nehemiah is saying, "Hey, but what was done to us? Maybe do that to them. You know, like maybe they can get a little, give them a little education on where we came from, what we've been dealing with. And you're like, well, that's pretty rough. And then this is the thing. The worst thing, not like worse isn't sinful, but like the harshest thing that you could possibly pray against somebody else is to say, do not cover their guilt and let not their sins be blotted from your sight. Now, this is the harshest of all things that you could pray for.
Yeah. I don't know of anything worse than that.
No, that's as bad as it gets, dude. Like you.
Can... Yes. I mean, this is typical imprecatory psalm language. Once we start covering the psalms, we'll get to some of those. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Psalm 109, for instance, which is quoted in reference later in the New Testament, is quoted in reference to Judas Iscariot. Yeah, that's some. That's some pretty rough language.
I think it's interesting too that he uses this provoked language, because we had talked about this, you know, as Israel was being led into exile and captive and stuff. We talked about all this provocation, right? That God had been long provoked, and had stated that he was being provoked over and over. Like, these people are provoking me. Like this is the proverbial stick and bear, right? Like this stick is constantly in my face and in my rib cage, and this is going on for a long time. And Nehemiah uses this same kind of language that is sort of calling on God to be fair. Like, hey, when we provoked you, this is what happened, this whole being plundered and captive and this kind of thing. And he makes the statement, for they have provoked you. Now, this isn't God saying that these people have provoked him, but Nehemiah saying that God should be provoked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So take a listen, God, to what's being said by these people. It's kind of like when we were, that was 2 Kings, where you have Hezekiah taking the letter that they sent. And basically spreading it out before God and saying, hey, read this.
Yeah.
See, have a listen to what these guys are saying about you and about our people and do something about it. And he did, you know, he had a whole lot of Assyrians being killed.
I think it's also interesting that these taunts and jeers aren't actually saying anything really about their God. I mean, like, it's mostly just mocking the people, but Nehemiah knows that the work that he's doing is the Lord's work, and so to mock the work is to mock the Lord. I think this is kind of the argument that Nehemiah is making in his prayer, because he's like, hey, they're provoking you by saying that we can't do this thing, or that everything that we're trying to do will fail, so this is actually a mocking of you, because, of course, this is your work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just like, you know, if you or I overheard some dude talking trash about our wives.
Yeah.
We wouldn't say, oh, well, that doesn't concern me because he's not talking about me.
Yeah.
of course he's talking about me because he's talking about my spouse. So you trash talk Israel, you know, you do all these things against the people of God. Well, you're dealing with God himself. It's what Christ said to Saul on the way to Damascus. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?
Yeah.
You know, you deal harshly with my people. Well, you're dealing harshly with me.
That's right.
So we get the prayer. Nehemiah just kind of throws that prayer up to God and knows that he's going to be heard. He that's one of the things I actually like about the imprecatory Psalms is it's a chance to verbalize this frustration with all of the terrible things that are happening. And then you basically like hand that to God and say, here, you deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to go take the measures into my own hands. I'm going to let you know that I know what's going on. And then I'm going to let you as the judge take care of the situation.
Yeah, this is some vengeance belongs to God kind of thing.
Yes, precisely.
So that is the biblical way. You don't take it into your own hands. You inform God of it and then hand it over to him. And then you'll see here, then you continue with your work. And you let him, vengeance belongs to God.
And I think that's one of the great lessons to learn from the imprecatory Psalms is that, I mean, we're all going to be angry about injustice, as we should be, you know? So what do you do about it? Well, you know, unless it's your vocation to deal with it, you simply pray psalms like this, and then you turn things over to the Lord and say, well, you've said vengeance is mine, I will repay. So there you go. Yep. I'm going to let you be God, and I'm going to be who I am.
Yep.
And then, like you say, I'm going to go about the labor that you've given to me, and I'm not going to let this stop me. So that's what they did, verse 6. And it goes right on and says, so we built the wall. It didn't slow down. And all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So I mean, making good progress. They're halfway there. Verse 7 says, but when our two friends here, Sanballat and Tobiah, and the Arabs, whoever those were, I mean, we're not told much about them. Some people think that this might have been an early name for the Idumeans, which lived in the place of Edom. So perhaps that's who we're talking about here. And then we have reference to the Ammonites, and those guys would have been the ones who lived east of the Jordan. And then another group thrown in here, the Ashdodites. So they're from Ashdod, and that was one of the cities in the Philistine Pentapolis. Evidently, when the Assyrians kind of took over, they changed the name of that province to Ashdod, and then that was adopted by the Persians. So anyway, two individuals, Sanballat and Tobiah, along with the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, all these guys heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed. So, predictably, they were very angry. A lot of anger going on here, if you haven't picked up on that already. Now, earlier they were just basically, you know, engaging in verbal abuse. Yeah, this wall's going to fall down if a fox jumps on it. What do you think you're going to finish this wall? It's you know, never gonna happen. So they shift from that to actually making plans to use military force in order to put a stop to this. So they were very angry, and verse 8, they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. So they're plotting. It's kind of a Psalm 2 kind of deal. You know, why do the nations, you know, plotting in vain? They're enraged against God. So that's what these guys are doing. So verse 9 says, we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. See, the tension is rising here. You know, it began with just kind of these verbal assaults. Now we have plotting to engage in some sort of violence against the city to make sure that this thing doesn't go anywhere. And so Nehemiah, they respond by, number one, praying, which is always a good thing. And number two, setting a guard as protection against them day and night. So, you know, pray to God that you're going to be safe in your house, but lock the door too, right? That's kind of the idea here.
Yes.
don't simply pray and say, oh, well, God's going to take care of me. You know, make sure that you're responsible for doing those things that you can do to make sure that you're going to be safe. Now, verse 10 shifts and says, in Judah, it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There's too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. So that's what is being said in Judah. We'll come back to that. Verse 11 says, our enemy said, they will not know or see till we come along among them and kill them and stop the work.
That is one way to stop the work.
That, yeah.
That'll stop it.
That would put a stop to the work right away. But verse 10, this, I don't know. It's sort of a like this is the mumbling, the rumors, the complaints that are going on in Judah. You certainly get the impression that maybe morale is beginning to slip here a little bit. The strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There's all this rubble that we're having to work with, and by ourselves, we're not going to be able to rebuild the wall. So maybe some of this jeering and taunting going on from Sanballat and Tobiah and the others is beginning to actually weaken the resolve of the builders. Because this is the kind of the talk that's going on. And then the enemies, yeah, I mean, they're like, well, we're going to take care of this. We're going to kill them. That'll stop the work. Verse 12 is a little bit ambiguous because the Hebrew there, according to every single commentary that I've looked at, everybody agrees that they're not exactly sure what to do with some of the Hebrew. I'll just read you what the ESV has. At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. I'm not sure what to do with that. I think it's probably just simply part of this whole fear that the work is not gonna happen, and that the enemies are going to be able to actually stop the wall building. But anyway, the overall impression is you got the enemies plotting, get them making plans, and you got maybe a weakening of morale and fears about what's going to happen among the people of Judah. So why does Nehemiah respond? Verse 13 says, "So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall in open places, I stationed people by their clans with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." It's not brought out in English translation, but there is a kind of a word play here going on. It says, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and fearsome, would be a better translation of that. I mean, awesome is fine, but it's the same verbal root for afraid as well as for awesome. So it's the idea of, listen, these guys, Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ashdodites, and everybody else who's, you know, throwing shade on us and threatening and plotting, don't be afraid of them. Instead, if you're going to direct your fear anywhere, direct it in a healthy sort of way to the fearsome God, who is great and who has a long proven track record of coming to his people's aid when they're threatened by their enemies and acting in such a way, either overtly or covertly, to stop the enemies from subverting the work that's being done.
Yeah.
So don't fear them, fear God. And when we say fear God, we mean believe in him, hope in him, trust in him, worship him, treat him as one who is fearsome.
Yeah, I like the idea of remembering the Lord, who is great and fearsome, but fighting for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your home. So one thing that sometimes people do is think that the Lord needs you to do something for him or to fight for him. So you know, back in the medieval times, you might say you're fighting for, you know, Christendom, or fighting for God, or fighting for righteousness, but none of that stuff is true. And the truth is that you remember God, and then you fight for the things that he's put into your life. You fight for the things, the people that he's made you responsible for, your neighbors and your family. And you remember that it's the Lord who fights for you. You don't have to fight for him. You fight for other things. You fight for those you're responsible for. You fight for the people that you love. And you remember that the Lord, who doesn't need you to fight for him and doesn't need anything from you, he actually is on your side.
Yeah, God doesn't need us to step into the ring for him.
No.
He's perfectly capable to take care of that himself. But, you know, our brothers, our sons, our daughters, our wives, yeah, they need us to step up and
yep.
and be faithful in our vocation of serving them. So remember the Lord, he's going to take care of you, and then you take care of those who are yep. around you. So verse 15 says, when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that so that when the enemies found out that the Israelites had found out their plots and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. And from that day on, half of my servants, so this is Nehemiah speaking, from that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and then half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the coats of mail. So they're continuing preparations, they're continuing repairs of the wall, but they're also at the same time making sure that there's a guard set up. So I mean, they're being faithful, but they're also being practical. They're believing, they're worshiping, they're trusting, they're praying, but they're also being faithful in the vocation to which God had called them. And that God had frustrated their plan, that's pretty typical language we have in a lot of other places in Scripture for what the way that God works for knowing what the enemies are doing, for knowing how they're plotting against him, and in his own divine sort of way, frustrating those plans from coming to their fulfillment. So the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building the wall, And those who carried the burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other. That had to have been so hard, by the way.
I feel like this is more I don't know how literally you want to take this, but I do think this probably means that everyone's got, you know, a sword or whatever, and the idea here is that they, you know, the saying you know, sleep with one eye open. That this is work with one hand on your sword. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're aware of what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, it goes on to say that each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while they built. And then Nehemiah had a guy with a shofar with a ram's horn beside him, ready to signal, you know, should there come an attack. And he says to the nobles and the officials and to the rest of the people, listen, we're spread out everywhere. There's a lot of work to be done. We're spread out everywhere. We're separated on the wall here and there. So if the enemies do attack, then my guy with the shofar is going to blow it. And when you hear that, we'll then rally around us there. And then he's got this great line, our God will fight for us.
There it is. So you know who's fighting for who.
Yeah. And I mean, this is typical language lifted from the Torah. For instance, you know, at the Red Sea and other places where God basically says, hey, listen, it's all going to be okay because I'm fighting for you. I'm your warrior. I'm your protector. And I'm going to step up and do what needs to be done. And just kind of, I think we can just wrap this up. I know we're at 40 minutes, but we only got two verses left. So Nehemiah says, we labored at the work and, you know, got these guys holding spears in the break of dawn till the stars come out. And he has everybody kind of spend the night in Jerusalem. He says, let every man, every servant pass the night in Jerusalem that they can be a guard for us by night and may labor during the day. And so that's what they did. And even when they went to bed, they kept their clothes on, kept their weapon at their right hand, ready to rise and to fight if need be. And if nothing happened, well, they get up in the morning, they go to work. So they're making progress, even though they've been hampered by threats and by, you know, possible attacks. They took measures and they kept on going through the work that they needed to do to get the wall built.
Yeah, nobody's getting in their pajamas during this thing. You sleep in your clothes with your sword in its sheath attached to your body. Like, that's how this is going to go.
Yeah, it's a pretty serious serious times in Israel.
Yeah. Well, all right. Yeah, that is it. That is chapter 4. We will be back next episode with chapter 5, and Nehemiah is going to have to, you know, he's not going to fight physical battles. He's going to have to fight some other battles that are going on.
Yeah, problems at home now amongst the Israelites.
Yeah, what do you know? Immediately, a problem has to be addressed internally. I got an internal problem here, and Nehemiah is going to address that. We will check that out next week. Hey, make sure you go down to the show notes, click that link, and support the podcast network fundraiser so we can keep all this stuff going. We greatly appreciate it. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.